world, of course. You'd make spears and bows from wood like the High Australia folk. But with time you would see your grandchildren growing ever clumsier, ever less interested, because the ability to run and fight counted for a lot more than the ability to make stuff. Minds like burning out candles. As Asher spoke, Jophiel glanced at Susan Chen. These homonyms, tree-climbing, nut-cracking, could well have descended from the crew of the Gourd. And yet, she did not seem distressed, not bitter or angry, still less horrified, oddly content with what she was finding. "That's enough," Michael Poole stood decisively. "It's clear to me there's nothing for us here. Take whatever samples and readings you need, Asher, Harris. We'll stay here one more watch, try to get some sleep, rotate the guard." He looked up as if seeking the sky. "Then we go on, to the grasslands, and beyond."
Chapter 65. Jophiel felt a great sense of relief to be back aboard the flyer, in the air and over an expansive grassland. A sea of rippling grass broken by scattered rivers and lakes, and small clumps of trees, a few rocky outcrops. A sense of release, he thought, to have been lifted out of the shadows of the trees. "Of course you feel like that," Harris Kemp said, when they talked about this. "You are evolved for the plain, open and full of light. Long eye lines where you can see what's coming over the horizon and it can see you. So both predators and prey are adapted for speed, for long-distance running. On a grassland, everything is in flight all the time." He was right. The flyer passed over fleeing herds. Big, heavy rabbits with thick, hairless hides. They were like elephants, or rhinos perhaps, equipped with horny skulls and sharp claws for defence. Or slimmer, more agile rabbits, with those big, muscular rear legs adapted to running, or in some cases, jumping. Rabbits distorted like gazelles or kangaroos. Some of these herds were enormous, and as the flyer crossed over, the streams of herbivores would be disrupted, the animals scattering. Then there were the carnivores that preyed upon the herbivores. Big, flightless birds that seemed, as Poole observed, to be reaching for genetic memories of the dinosaurs. And people. Max, sharp-eyed, was the first to spot them. He sat up on his couch and pointed, "There, look! No doubt about it, a band must be about 50. Jophiel peered down. They didn't look like chimps or gorillas this time. Slim, tall-looking, they were naked out on the plain. Adults, some children, a few infants on their parents' backs. He saw that some of them surrounded a fallen animal, apparently one of the elephantine rabbits, and were hastily butchering it. They didn't look up as the flyer crossed over. Evidently they didn't expect any visitors from the sky. "So, hunters," Max said, "and carnivores." Weena spoke, surprising Jophiel.
"No, not hunters. Look."
She rarely contributed to the discussions of the group. It wasn't that she was shy, Jophiel thought. It was just that she stuck to her own area of expertise and spoke only when she had something to say. A habit, Nicola had once observed dryly, that a few others among this crew could do with copying. Now she showed Jophiel a magnified image on a soft screen. "This animal was not brought down by weapons, by spears or arrows, see? His throat has been torn out by big teeth."
"Ah," Asher said, blowing up the image further. "Killed by one of the big predators, then. So the real killers abandoned their catch for some reason."
Weena nodded.
"And these people moved in to take the meat."
"They are scavengers," Max said.
Humans scavenging over prey brought down by rats. He laughed. How pathetic. Weena looked offended, angry.
There is no shame. If you are hungry, you take your meat where you find it.
You're right, Harris said grimly. And you, Max, shouldn't believe the stories about the heroic advance of humanity they told you when you were a kid. We always scavenged, or our ancestors did.
Let's take her down and see, Poole said firmly.
That turned out not to be so easy. As soon as the flyer started to descend, the human types noticed it at last. They broke up into smaller groups, adults grabbing children, and scattered. Weena laughed now.
They are so fast. A race between them and the best runners of the people of the vanquished first slaver would be interesting.
Jophiel saw that one small group, away from the flyer, had paused. They had taken chunks of meat from the kill. Now they dumped this on the ground and began to eat, hastily, almost furtively, expecting it to be stolen, Jophiel saw. The lure of the food overcame their fear for now, though they stared fixedly at the flyer.
Send me down, Jophiel said on impulse. Split off a copy, let's just take one close look before we move on.
Nicola raised a silver sketch of an eyebrow.
Dressed like that?
He glanced down at his bright blue coverall.
So, give me a neutral colour.
He thought of that other pool.
Give me grey, he suits it.
Michael Poole looked at him oddly.
Who?
Never mind. Just do it. And he was on the plane, in an infinity of grass, an abstraction. It was like a virtual environment on the gear, perhaps. He stood facing the group. One child, looking over its mother's shoulder, spotted him. It gurgled and pointed. Jophiel smiled. One by one, the runners turned, saw him, eyes widening. Parents instinctively reached for their young, but they did not flee. Harris murmured in his ear,
"They don't know if you are a threat or prey. They've never seen anything like you. Just stand still."
One tall male stood up, stared at Jophiel, and jabbered what sounded like a paragraph of speech, but probably wasn't. He walked forward, and he loomed over Jophiel.
They were all so tall,
Jophiel saw immediately, women and men alike, and their bodies well balanced, with muscular limbs, broad shoulders, flat torsos, like decathletes, perhaps, trained for a variety of sports, for speed and strength and agility.
"Sit down," Harris murmured now. "Sit on the ground. The less you look like a threat, the better."
Good idea, but too late, Jophiel thought. Even as he sat, the big male hurried off, apparently alarmed. The group gathered back at the spot where they had been eating and stood in a circle, the younger adults facing out, the older adults and the infants inside. Jophiel saw now that a couple of the adults held weapons, just roughly sharpened wooden spears, though the tips were blackened. Asher had noticed the same thing.
"Fire hardened," she murmured to Jophiel.
"So maybe they still have fire."
She shrugged.
"Or they just exploit lightning strikes."
When no immediate threat came from Jophiel, the next step seemed to be exploration. One young woman walked out of the group, hesitantly and yet defiantly, for she walked straight up to Jophiel.
"Remarkable," Jophiel breathed.
Cautiously he got to his feet and approached her. The woman flinched back. Then, when he offered no threat, she walked around him. Jophiel could see the fine hairs on her bare skin, smell a scent of dust and sweat. She was quite naked, her hands empty.
"She's beautiful. They all are. Perfect bodies, almost an idealized human form.
like the stars of some virtual soap opera. He laughed, making the woman flinch, but she stood her ground.
Sorry, he said.
Flat stomach, strong shoulders, well-muscled limbs. She's meant for running. Very well adapted to the plane of grass, evidently. He had to look up to meet her eyes. Taller than me. Eyes quite normal as far as I can see. Human eyes with whites, not like an ape's. But the head. The shape of the face. Her jaw was too heavy, too strong. Her nose was broad and flat. Her eyes were sheltered from the light of the sky by a heavy, bony ridge, and the brow behind that eye ridge was flat, receding, and her skull small at the back. For all her athlete's body, Jophiel felt he could have cupped that skull in one hand as if cradling a baby's head.
Her eyes look human, Jophiel said, as human as mine, bright, but calculating.
It's like looking into the eyes of an animal, a lion, maybe. Abruptly, she raised a hand and thrust it, as if to grab Jophiel's throat. Jophiel recoiled instinctively, though she could not harm him. There was a stinging flare of pixels where her flesh touched his, and she flinched back. Her face twisted in anger, in threat, and she jabbered a string of syllables at him. Harris murmured, "Just stay calm. They're acting on instinct. They can't work out if you're a predator out to eat them or a rival runner meaning to attack them or steal their kids. So you have a mix of instinctive responses."
Jophiel frowned. "Instinctive?"
"I agree," Asher said. "Instinctive, not decision-making as we understand it. I've been analysing their speech." "That threat she just uttered," Jophiel, "barely any semantic content, just a screech of challenge or warning. As we said, just like in the jungle, this isn't an environment where a big, heavy brain is an asset. If you put all that energy into running instead..."
"And give it 500,000 years, Jophiel said a little bitterly. "Then the result is this. Beautiful emptiness."
"Now you're being parochial, Jophiel. These are animals perfectly fit to their environment. In fact, I think they're a close analogue of Homo erectus. More of those, living solutions evidently still there in our genomes for when they are needed again. And probably easier for evolution to reach for, if I can put it that way. Just changes in the relative growth rates of organs, for instance.
Bigger hearts, smaller heads.
Something like that."
Max Ward growled, "Maybe so. But they lost their humanity and they're not even the dominant animal on this savanna, are they? As Weena said, they're just scavengers."
Susan scowled. "What of it? Homo erectus lasted millions of years. Maybe they will last just as long here. When we are long gone, pursuing our foolish dreams, their children will still be here, running in the light."
Without warning, with a snap, Jophiel was brought back to the flyer. He staggered, feeling a little drunk. "Ow! A little warning would have been nice. And I bet you scared the runners again." Michael Poole stood before him, grinning.
"Never mind the runners. We've got much bigger news than that."
Jophiel guessed wildly.
"Your drones have reported in."
Nicola stood back, arms folded.
"Some of them. In particular, the one we sent to the summit of Central Mountain."
"Just tell me."
"It found a wormhole."
Part 6. In case of emergency, break laws of physics. Harry Poole, 3829 AD. Chapter 66. Ship elapsed time since launch, 27 years, 182 days. Earth date, circa 2,710,000 AD. Nicola stayed at the top of the mountain,
and sent the uncrewed flyer back for the rest. They loaded up quickly. Then, under Michael Poole's piloting, the flyer swept smoothly up the western flank of Central Mountain. The higher they climbed, the more fake the mountain looked to Jophiel. The lower slopes, where the mountain emerged from a sea of grassland, seemed authentic enough, with grass, scrub, and scattered clumps of trees clinging to an increasingly steep, rocky face. There were animals there, too. Post rabbits with skinny frames and long legs that made them look like goats. And in one place, as Cianello excitedly pointed out, people, or post-people anyhow, a small band of enterprising hunters who scattered at the approach of this unfamiliar monster, the Flyer. From here, when Jophiel turned and glanced back, he got a wide view of the landscapes of the Cup World. A swathe of grassland, a patch of forest, a river decanting into a lake that flooded a strangely angular basin. From up here the land looked as if it had been cracked and broken, the fragments crudely glued back together. Past a certain height the efforts of life to colonize gave way to bare rock. Then, higher still as the flyer continued its relentless climb towards a sky of rippling light, the rock itself started to show gaps, like a canvas stretched so far its paint had cracked and flaked away, and Jophiel saw the pale uniform gleam of hull plate, the true substrate of this mask world. But the hull plate itself looked jumbled, tipped up, distorted. Nicola pointed out ridges of thicker material where, apparently, new hull plate had been grown over to seal wounds, and a mountain that was evidently no mountain at all. Jophiel wondered if it had been something like the creation of a central mountain in a lunar crater, caused by a strike by an asteroid or comet nucleus. Such a mountain was a kind of frozen, reflected ripple at the centre of a circular scar, in bedrock that had been smashed and broken and melted and splashed. Hull plate wasn't bedrock, but maybe this mountain was a similar phenomenon, a wave of destruction that had focused here at the geometric centre of the roughly circular cup world, a focused distortion that had thrust up this kilometres-high peak, and then, as the hull plate somehow recovered, been left frozen in place. There was a kick as the flyer's small fusion-powered rockets cut in, and an aircraft morphed into a spacecraft. They flew above the air now. Above Jophiel's head, the artificial sky was deepening to a blue-black, across which the strange day-night bands of brighter illumination were strikingly obvious, and through which the red stars of the galaxy centre could clearly be seen, a dismal veil. The flyer at last soared up and over a rim. Here Chile hull plate had been stretched beyond endurance, and at last had torn and cracked. The result was a fence of jagged, lethal-looking peaks, spikes of stretched hull plate, through which the flyer swam smoothly. And beyond the fence, the summit itself spread out before them. It was a plane of what looked like pure hull plate, more smashed fragments crudely stitched together, with here and there clumps of broken rock. Poole brought the flyer low down as it crossed an expanse fully 50 kilometres wide, enclosed by those hull plate spikes. Jophiel was reminded of flights over Olympus Mons, greatest mountain on Mars, a volcano whose summit was a plain pocked by multiple calderas. And there, at what looked to Jophiel like the geometric centre, a bright spot of earth green, a dome, the shelter that had supported Nicola through her stay up here, while she had sent back the flyer for Poole and the rest. Beside the dome, a scrap of sky blue, a cube. floating above the ground. The flyer landed a respectful distance away. The crew clambered down to the surface. And surface, not ground, Jophiel thought, was the right word for this section of the artificial world. Here at the climax of this tremendous wound, the hull plate was bare, exposed in places, fractured into overlapping plates that were stitched together by clumsy, thick welds. The Cauchy crew, in their skin suits, clambered cautiously over this as they made for Nicola's dome. "Take it slow," Nicola said, greeting them. She wore her custom-adapted skin suit. "Easy to crack an ankle up here. We're still under a full gravity, remember?" And she led them to her discovery, the sky-blue artifact. They clustered around it. Close to, the object seemed as simple as it had from a distance, Jophiel thought. Just a cube, maybe 10 meters on a side. Jophiel thought he saw faint lines in the surface, nested squares engraved within the otherwise smooth faces. And the cube was floating a meter off the ground, no apparent support. Asher checked this out. She got down on her hands and knees, waved a gloved hand under the floating box, repeated the exercise with a grappling rod she took from the flyer. "Nothing holding it up," she shrugged. "Anti-gravity? Electrostatics? Some kind of repulsion effect from the hull plate?" Poole growled. "In the circumstances, that seems a minor miracle. But this doesn't look like any kind of wormhole to me, Nicola." She shrugged. "Maybe it isn't a wormhole. You're the specialist, Michael. You haven't seen it all yet. Wormhole was the best label I had for it." "Show me, then." She walked up to the cube and traced the engravings in the nearest face. "See these marks? That look like the edges of hatches. That's exactly what they are. Hatches. And remarkably simple." With one gloved hand, she pushed at the innermost panel, which swung up and back, as if from a hinge set in the top edge, revealing a way into the cube, a hole in the wall maybe a meter across. A blue glow within, Jophiel saw. "It just seems to fold back. I didn't investigate the mechanics of that too closely. The lack of a hinge seemed another minor miracle, as you put it, Poole. But before I went in, I did establish that the bigger groove marks are indeed the edges of another hatch. For passing wider loads, I guess. Very practical."
"Hold up," Max Ward said. "You were up here alone. You went in. Without reporting back, without backup."
"Spare me the military protocol, Max. Tell me you wouldn't have done the same thing."
"Never mind," Poole said. "Show us."
She fetched a short ladder from her life support dome, set it against the floating cube, stepped back, and grinned. "Cube off the ground? Ladder leaning against its side? Looks like some surrealist art installation, don't you think? And an unassuming bit of kit for such an epochal discovery, you'll agree."
"Get on with it," Poole growled.
"Barbarian." With a fluid grace that belied her bulk, she climbed the ladder, then gripped the frame, swung her legs into the hatchway, and dropped through and out of sight. "Still hear me? Have to admit I kept that hatch propped open when I was in here on my own." Chinello immediately said, "I'll go in with her."
"No," Poole said. "Not until we know what we're dealing with."
He glanced at Jophiel. "You, Jophiel, you next." Asher frowned. "His survival or otherwise will prove nothing about the safety of the containment for regular humans."
Jophiel smiled. "True. But once again, it is a test of our systems, and I am disposable, relatively."
"Only one way to find out," he muttered.
He snapped his fingers. And here he was, inside the cube, standing beside Nicola on a smooth floor, within blank walls that seemed to glow with their own soft blue light, the floor and ceiling too. In this wash of light, the two of them cast no shadows. Nicola was grinning.
Once again, the two of us into the unknown. The heart of the sun, the centre of the galaxy, now this. It's getting to be a habit, Jophiel.
Jophiel grinned back. Poole said, "Still with us, Jophiel?"
"Still here," he reported.
"The systems embedded in Nicola's suit are evidently maintaining my projection, like they're supposed to." All human tech was designed to support augmented reality unobtrusively, and it worked, even in an environment as extreme as this. He looked around. This was an almost featureless box. There were more of those hatchway grooves, their functions obvious, in walls, roof and floor. Otherwise, nothing. He pulled a soft screen from a pouch on his skin suit leg, shook it out. It was a virtual construct, but slave to the flyer's systems. He began to upload instrument analyses, hoping Asher would be able to squeeze out more meaning than he had so far. He felt a little lost. Nicola was watching him with a mocking grin.
"Come on, Jophiel. Even I made faster progress than this. What do you see?"
"Lots more hatches," he said lamely.
"Well spotted. All functional as well.
Big hatches and little hatches.
They all work. Try them."
"Oh, you can't. Poor ghostly Jophiel.
Well, I discovered you can just push them open from either side.
I felt like a rat in a lab cage exploring all this,
all leading nowhere, just out of the cube, save for..."
She glanced at the floor. He looked down at the usual set of nested edges.
"Save for what?"
"A trapdoor to the ground. I mean, it's only a meter's clearance between the ground and this floating box. Those big hatches wouldn't even open all the way before fouling."
She shrugged.
"If you say so."
"Show me."
She knelt, a little stiffly in her confining skin suit, leaned forward, and pressed on the floor's innermost hatch. It hinged down easily, not impeded at all by the ground that was, Jophiel thought, supposed to be in the way. Hinged down to reveal a blue glow shining up from the hole. Jophiel came forward cautiously. He should have been looking through a hole in the floor to a ground of scarred hull plate and scattered dirt. Instead, another room. He knelt and ducked down to see more. The lower chamber was identical to the room he was in, complete with hatch marks on the walls and floor, and presumably in the ceiling he was looking down through. It was like looking into a mirror or a still pond, a reflection of the room behind him, but without his own face peering back at him. He leaned back. A room 10 meters deep, where there should be a meter of vacuum above a solid floor.
"You got it."
"A paradox? Some kind of illusion, like a virtual trick?" She shook her head.
"More physical than that. I went further. I climbed down..."
Jophiel suppressed a groan, not wishing to sound like Max Ward.
"Of course you did.
Thousands of kilometers from the nearest backup.
If it's some illusion, it's a remarkable one. I was able to stand up straight down there. I even improvised a measuring rod from the flyer's repair kit. I opened it out to 20 meters from the floor of that lower chamber to the ceiling of this upper. This space is as real as that measuring rod, as me, and a lot more real than you."
He stood up. "Fine. But Nicola, you called this a wormhole. Some kind of
of higher dimensional trickery doesn't make it that.
I know that. A wormhole is a road, a route. But you see, I went further. I opened the lower hatch down in the cellar there. Nothing but darkness. Even I didn't take the chance of going further, but I did drop in a drone probe. It passed through the hatch space easily enough. I think it's still down there. Well, I know it is. I programmed it to observe, report back. But there was a mismatch. It took 17 minutes here to capture a single microsecond's worth of data gathered down there. Jophiel ran those numbers in his head. Ah, 1,000,000 to 1. Yes, you see it. Time down there in the subcellar is running at the same rate as down on deck 1 where the Chili lives. And so the obvious conclusion is that it is down on deck 1. That this nest of cubes is a passageway. Good thinking. And that is why I called it a wormhole. It's not, but it's obviously a transit system. Across more than 1,000 astronomical units from up here to down there. It somehow manages the speed-up transition, the time dilation, but because of that, it's effectively one way. She looked at him. Michael Poole is going to go through. Jophiel nodded. And we must follow, he said. Chapter 67.
I knew it, said Michael Poole. As soon as Nicola and Asher suggested it, I knew they were right. This mountaintop had to be a construction shack.
Poole was pacing in the confined space of Nicola's survival shelter, his skinsuit hood lying back on his neck to reveal thick hair that was greying despite decades of AS treatment. A blunt face, Jophiel thought, once again watching himself from the outside. The skin, space pale, somehow coarsened by habitual expressions of determination. And a very different Poole from Jophiel's occasional visitor, who was maybe no older physically, but wiser, gentler. This was a Michael Poole whose life, whose universe, had taken a wrong turning, Jophiel thought now. Yet still, this damaged, flawed Michael Poole led all the humans on this wheel, and Jophiel himself. They sat and listened. Jophiel, Nicola, Max, Susan, Cinello. The rest of the crew was scattered. Back up at the Rim Mountains with the trucks, some still down on the plain. But some had projected virtuals over, including, to Jophiel's mild surprise, Michaela Nadathur, first of the next generation. Maybe the wider crew sensed this was a key moment. They probably weren't wrong, Jophiel thought.
I knew it, Poole said again. There had to be an access point, a base, for the work required to fix up this cup world, if not the whole of this part of the wheel. And the mountain, not really part of the cup world at all, was an obvious place to put the wormhole.
Which was the name they had settled on for a transport technology that was, Jophiel thought, as far advanced over the old Poole Industry space-time wormholes as those wormholes themselves were advanced over George Stevenson's first passenger railways. But Nicola's label had stuck. Maybe it even came through itself if its physical size allowed it. Poole glared around.
Maybe the Chili was right here. On this cup world. And maybe it left the wormhole in place in case it needed to come back here and fix more stuff. And if the Chili can travel this way, then we can follow it. Just as Nicola already proved with her drone. We thought we were cut off from deck 1 by the damage done to the wheel. Well, we aren't. Thanks to the Chili itself. Now we can go and finish the job we came to do.
By Michael Poole's standards, that was meant to be an uplifting speech, Jophiel realised. He was met by flat silence. At length, Cinello Thomas, 18 years old, got to her feet.
We followed you this far, Michael, and I guess we'll go the rest of the way too.
She sat again.
Weena of High Australia stood too.
You have my arrows, Michael Poole.
But now Michaela Nadathur stood up. 31 years old, quiet, grave, slim, and apparently more interested in sports challenges than the affairs of the ship. Jophiel didn't think he'd ever heard her speak at a crew briefing before, yet she had a certain quiet authority. And it seemed, this time, she had something to say. She glanced around at Poole, Max.
Some others asked me to speak today because you oldsters might listen to me. What with me being like a symbol. I was the firstborn of the second generation of the flotilla. Why, my parents named me after you, Michael. And with all respect, Cinello, you do what you like. I admire you. You're always out there in front, but you don't speak for all of us.
Cinello stayed seated but frowned. Max Ward was watching all this warily, as if they were close to a mutiny. Jophiel saw Nicola grinning. Poole was gracious enough.
Fair enough.
If you speak for the others...
No, she said. We're not that organized. We just want to ask questions. You said you wanted to finish the job you started, which is to find the Chile and... Well... Then what? I mean, so much has changed. What is the Chile doing here on this wheel?
Poole was evidently reining in his impatience.
You heard the briefings.
You know what it's doing, as best we can guess. Look, we know the wheel is basically a time machine, one way. The Chile was wounded during the battle for the solar system, so it came here, to the galaxy core black hole, and is hiding out, perhaps even healing until...
But that can't be all, Michaela said. Why build the wheel? I mean the decks, the cup worlds. Why build all those refuges for all these alien races? See, I think, many of us think, that this wheel is exactly what it looks like. It's not some kind of fortress, it's an ark. It's a haven for our way of life, life like ours, like the Chile. Life made of light matter as opposed to the spooky dark matter stuff that the Chile are fighting in their big war. The wheel has already lasted a long time as a haven. Why, the runners and tree climbers on this cupworld have been here so long they've had time to evolve. And not only that, when this cupworld was damaged, the Chile came out here to fix it. You proved that yourself, Michael. The Chile cares for its creation and presumably the creatures that live on it. Maybe the Chile means to save us all somehow, not just itself.
Poole studied her as if baffled. Make your point, Michaela. What are you saying? She seemed to take some time to summon up the courage to reply. But then, Jophiel was slowly realizing, she was challenging the orthodoxy that had governed this mission since she had been born, which, he supposed, was just what a new generation was supposed to do. He found himself silently urging her on.
Speak well, Michaela. I'm saying that we do understand what you mean when you say you'll finish the job. You don't want to just find the Chile, you don't want to understand it, you want to hunt it down and destroy it.
Poole frowned. We crossed the galaxy to do just that. After it came to the solar system and tried to eliminate humanity altogether... Michaela said in a rush,
but it came from a timeline where humans inflicted a huge extinction event on the whole galaxy. From its point of view, it isn't just destroying stuff for the sake of it, it's putting something right.
I came here to destroy it. That was the purpose of the expedition.
Yes. Because of what happened before any of us were born. We never knew Earth. We never even knew cold Earth.
Michael Poole paced, looking furious, frustrated. Jophiel found himself intrigued, disturbed. Of course, she was right. An oath of vengeance taken by a 44-year-old Poole back on the frozen ruin of the home world had seemed noble, even inevitable at the time. And it had propelled this quixotic mission across the face of the galaxy. But nobody back then had ever imagined this. Nobody had planned for how the next generation might feel about it. They must have managed things better in that other lost timeline, he thought now, where, according to the Poole family archive, a 20,000-year war had been fought and won with child soldiers. Endless generations shaped under a ghastly galaxy-wide authority, apparently called the Coalition of Interim Governance. We look like amateurs compared to that lot, he reflected. Yet, here we are. He asked now, gently, "What would you have us do, Michaela?"
"We did come here for a purpose. To defeat the Chili. But that doesn't look so simple now. Across this vast distance, through so much time, we should deal with what we've actually found."
"And so?"
"The Chili. Spare it. Let it finish the job it started here. Let it save itself and whatever else it has collected here, because killing it won't bring back Earth."
Susan nodded earnestly.
"And then? What for you, child?" "We've thought about that," Michaela said quickly. "It's not that we've been conspiring."
Max Ward glared.
"We want to stay here, in High Africa. Look, it's another Earth. It's been stable a long time and evidently even survived the star impacts on the wheel. We can live here safely." "That was the point, wasn't it? We thought this cup world, High Africa, would be a refuge for the long term."
Max growled. "And a base from which to strike at the Chili." Michaela insisted.
"But we don't have to follow that through. Instead..."
Max Ward sneered. "Instead what? Climb trees and run away from giant rats and wait for your mind to dissolve?"
"It doesn't have to be that way," Michaela said defiantly. "And it's not as if there's anywhere else to go. This is all there is. This world is the only home we will ever have except for the inside of a truck. And now it's our turn to choose. We don't want to go through that wormhole, Michael. Whatever lies beyond. Some of us, anyhow. We can't stop you going through and facing the Chili, but we don't want to wage war. We want to live. And we want to live here."
She grinned.
"We have a whole world. Who knows what we'll achieve?"
She seemed to stumble to a halt, looked around uncertainly, and sat down. Jophiel had to smile.
"It's just like when the island broke away. Here we go again."
And Nicola started to clap, a heavy, unreal sound with human hands encased in glove-like ghost hide.
"Well said, Michaela. We may be a bunch of brutalized relics, but somehow we managed to raise a bunch of smart kids."
For a few more seconds she clapped alone. Then Susan Chen joined in, and Harris Kemp, and Cinello, Michaela's tentative rival for the leadership of the new generation. Then Jophiel. Though that earned him an angry glare from Max Ward, and a baffled glance from Poole, who stood unsmiling. When the applause died down, Poole stepped forward.
"I hear you, Michaela." He looked around. "I hear you all, but I'm... Look, I'm not a soldier. This isn't a troop ship or a prison. I can't, won't, force anyone who chooses not to follow."
"But," Asher said, standing up, "if we're talking about splitting again, before we go on with this, there's something I need to make crystal clear to all of you, all of us. Suppose you do stay while Michael and others go on. The choice to separate, once made, can't be unmade because of the time dilation.
If Michael goes down into the time pit, down to deck one, in an hour for Michael, a century will pass up here. And if he comes back after a day, this moment, which we experience now, will be more than 2 millennia gone. If your descendants survive at all, he will be history at best, or legend, or forgotten at worst, and after a week, a month... Look, if we split now, it's for good. Well, that's all I have to say.
She sat down. Poole stepped forward.
Fine.
Are we done? Given all that's been said, and we're going to have to consult the whole crew properly, I know. How many of you want to stay?
It really was just like the island split all over again. Max glowered. The vote was a hesitant one, and Jophiel wondered if some of the rebels feared some kind of reprisal. But the result was clear enough. Cinello came to stand by Poole's side, but about half the crew, including most of Michaela's generation, did not want to follow Michael Poole any further. Chapter 68. Ship elapsed time since launch, 27 years, 187 days. Earth date, circa 2,710,000 AD. It was another complicated and painful separation. Sharing out the trucks and other equipment was the easy part. Splitting the people was trickier. Most of the seniors opted to stay with Poole. Jophiel himself, Max Ward, Nicola, Asher, Harris, Cinello, Susan Chen too.
To the end, Michael Poole, to the end.
But as far as the crew was concerned, that preliminary vote proved not to be quite definitive. Some crew changed sides through fear, or perhaps hope, Jophiel thought, regarding the strange alternative destinies on offer. A life either on a damaged artificial world or in the bowels of a Chile artifact. Then there was some rejigging of the lists when Harris, with the backup of Poole and others, gave stern warnings about the need to maximize genetic diversity within each of the two halves of the crew. 25 or so was a low number for a colony's founding population, but not, impossibly so, not if the founders were genetically diverse enough to begin with. But Harris, having the data to hand, was able to show that the split, as initially proposed, was far from optimal, genetically speaking. He insisted on a few tweaks. Poole asked for volunteers to switch sides, and was deeply relieved, Jophiel thought, to get them, and not to have to transfer crew by order or even compulsion. It did mean that a few sets of siblings were broken up. Bob Thomas would go through with Cinello, but there were cases of children leaving their parents. Even after that, Jophiel found himself hesitantly approaching Poole with more issues.
"We have some oddities," Jophiel said.
"Oddities?"
"Weena from High Australia wants to go through."
"Let her. Our captured ghost?"
"Bring it," Poole grinned, wolfish. "Might be entertaining to bring the two great enemies of mankind together.
What else?"
Jophiel hesitated. He had a vision of that other Poole, the one who should have existed, and the one urgent request he had made of Jophiel.
"The dark matter pod.
With the Fotino fish inside."
Poole frowned.
"That we retrieved at Guba Star?"
"Yes."
"So?"
"So," Jophiel said, his voice an urgent whisper, "we need to make sure we take it with us. Down to deck one."
Poole rubbed his nose.
"Why?"
"Those fish are in a lifeboat of their own already. They'll be safe here on deck 3. Why should we clutter up our trucks with that?"
Jophiel wrestled with the decision. I can't tell you that. Not yet. It's complicated. Look, I'll see to it myself. But I'm a virtual. I'm only ever one system crash away from extinction. I want to be sure this happens, and I want you to promise me you'll do it. Poole rarely looked his virtual copy in the face. He did so now. Why do you care so much? Jophiel sighed. Suppose I said, because you told me so. Poole thought that over and grinned. We're Pooles. For us, that doesn't even register as odd. Sure. I'll make sure it's saved, okay? Now leave me alone, you fruitcake. Get back to work. Because of the time dilation, the final passage through the wormhole was complicated and extended. They soon worked out that you couldn't shove people and material down at random through the wormhole. A second down there mapped to 11 days on Deck 3. Just shove stuff through and there would soon be a disorderly heap. So the transition was planned, rehearsed, and the crew took their time. The party's trucks and other equipment were disassembled and passed through component by component, with bots on either side of the wormhole, and people followed too, each in their skin suit, lugging personal gear two or three at a time. It took a whole year by Deck 3 time, a year more after a quarter-century mission. But on Deck 1, the whole pile came through in seconds, and the bots worked frantically to retrieve the gear and hustle the people out of the way. And when it was done, Poole and Jophiel were the last to enter the Chile wormhole and pass through to the other side. In the gloom of what felt like a basement, for a moment the two of them stood side by side in an anonymous blue box. Jophiel thought he could feel the heaviness of time down here, gummed up as it was with the glue of relativity. And they were surrounded by a slowly dispersing crowd of people and their gear, that year of flow compressed into a minute. Jophiel glimpsed the ghost, caged and heavily guarded. Take a deep breath, he said now. Another. Say 5 seconds a breath. Down here, 5 seconds maps onto 60 days up there. Take 5 more breaths. A year. Michaela and her crew are already forgetting us. 10 or 12 breaths, 2 years gone already. Enough, Poole growled. We have work to do. And listen, now we're down here, I figure we have just 167 ship days left before the Chile hits its great attractor completion milestone. 5 million years. Whatever we do, it has to be before then. Let's get started. And he stomped out of the chamber. Jophiel stayed for a while, just counting his breaths. Remembering faces he would never see again, no matter what the future held. Then he followed his template. Chapter 69. Back on Deck 1. It all felt familiar to Jophiel. The bare hull plate surface, the relativistic sky red and blue, a sky where rays of light followed curved lines, he realized. The people standing around with their stuff, it almost seemed mundane. Once the wormhole hatch was closed, Max Ward immediately took charge. He called together most of the crew into one of the trucks. Only a few were left outside on what he called guard duty. They crowded in. And Max faced down Michael Poole. Look, Max said bluntly, we're now back in enemy territory and we're going to get a lot closer to the foe, right? Because we're here to take on the Chile. This situation is why you brought me here, Michael, precisely why. And if you aren't going to listen to me now, then when? Drophiel watched uncertainly as Poole faced him, neither aggressively nor passively, Drophiel thought. Drophiel was uneasy about Max's general demeanour. Tense, impatient. Nicola caught Drophiel's eye. Her silvered face was all but expressionless. But he could see what she was thinking, how she was harbouring the same doubts. Maybe the man had just been through too much strangeness, too much change, the latest being this strange time-shift isolation from so many of the crew he had been training for years. If Poole felt the same, he didn't show it. Your priorities, Max? I guess to get a habitat of some kind established. Max shook his head. There you go. That's not the priority at all. Our priority now, our only priority, is engagement with the Chili. And everything we do has to be shaped by that. And why? Because we're so close. And we have so little time. Just 167 days, remember, before that weird 5-million-year deadline. So, how far away is the Chili? Asher said, We think around 1 million kilometres. A rueful smile. In most circumstances, that would seem a long way. Now we've got here, we can confirm that anyhow. That's based on observation of gravity wave anomalies, a known signature of Chili tech. Cinello, default leader of the younger crew, frowned at that. And does the Chili know we're here? Max pointed at her. Good question. We have to assume it does, unless proven otherwise. I mean, here we are crawling around the artifact like we escaped from a cup world, monkeys out of a cage. It must, no, it must sense us and our crawling caravans. Somehow Drophiel hadn't thought that through. Why was it the Chili hadn't dealt with the rogue humans long before? It must have sensed the crash of the Couchy in the first place. Was it watching them, even now? Was it waiting for them to fall into some kind of trap? Or... Keep going, Drophiel. Finish the thought. That odd, gravelly voice in his unreal ear. Or, he thought, the Chili meant them no harm. Heretical. I'd keep that to myself if I were you. So, Max said, 1 million clicks. How do we get there? 1 million kilometres. Poole gazed into a soft screen. We have the trucks and the flyer. We need the trucks to live in. The flyer's a lot faster, but it has a small capacity and is really meant for high-altitude flight. And that's a risk. The Couchy was downed by the wheel's impact defences, remember? Also, we already know that the hull plate river solution won't work. It's not flowing in this part of the wheel. Maybe because of the stellar impact damage. Then we need speed close to the ground, Max said. Poole nodded. So we rig something up with a flyer. A low-level capability, maybe based on some kind of ground effect. Downward thrusters to keep us above the hull plate floor, effectively frictionless. Essentially, we adapt the flyer as a hovercraft. You could reach some pretty high speeds that way, even at low level. How fast? Poole shrugged. 1,000 kilometres an hour? So it would take 40-50 days of flight to get to the Chili? Max rubbed his chin. That will have to do. But we only have 167 days. Realistically, at that rate, we won't have time for more than one return mission, right? We need to get it right first time. Nicola grinned. A ride at super speed a few meters above the floor of an alien artifact. I volunteer to pilot. Fine, Max snarled. So pick a backup and a backup for the backup and train yourselves up. This isn't some stunt, Emery. We're taking on an enemy here, and we have to assume the environment itself is hostile. 7 days, he said now. Poole looked confused. 7 days? To finalize a plan.
to sort out our gear and prepare our assault. Look, I know we just went through a trauma. There is such a thing as pushing too hard, but...